Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, a very different beginning to the podcast of Not The Footy Show, because obviously the great Gordon Banks passed away, and we had him as a guest on the show a couple of times, and he was my hero growing up, and we just thought we'd pay him a little bit of a tribute and just say, look, what a wonderful memories we have of him. He was fighting illness towards the end, had a wonderful life, and I'm pleased to say I got to meet him, and yeah. Rest in peace, Gordon.
And the interviews you did with Gordon were fantastic, by the way. Actually, I really enjoyed them. And I think we'll have to retire that sting now.
We will indeed. But we will never forget, obviously, the great Gordon Banks. But, John, it's good to be back. I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And as usual, we've got a fantastic podcast lined up for you today. We're going to be catching up with our guest on this show is Kylie Fulmer, who hails from Bathurst, but was living in Perth for a long time before she decided to turn professional into women's boxing. And at the end of last year, she won the World Boxing Federation Women's Intercontinental Super Bantamweight World Championship. And I've been trying to get hold of her since then, but she was back in Australia for Christmas. Managed to get hold of her. I do apologise when it starts, because there's a little bit of crackle on the line, but it does get better, so stick with it.
Great. What are we going to start with?
Well, I want to start with, I think, the whole... We're not going to go into the whole Alan Stajic sacking of the Matildas, but I think what I'd like to do is look at some of the elements that are involved in that and how the FFA have completely stuffed things up.
Are we replaying an earlier podcast, are we?
Well, yeah, we could have been going back about 5 or 6 years, couldn't we, John? I mean, it is just unbelievable how... They've accused, obviously, the Matildas culture within the Matildas as being toxic. Man, that word is getting overused. Seriously, they were producing results. They were doing well. Now, since then, and Alan Stajic has come out and made his comments, they've said that he admitted that things were dysfunctional. Well, wow, that is a surprise. Hasn't the FFA been dysfunctional for a very long time? We had the last year where the board was proving to be dysfunctional because there were certain people dominating it and basically pushing their own agenda rather than actually what was best for the game.
You had FIFA come in and actually tell them that you will be banned from international competition unless you get your off-field stuff right. Exactly these sorts of issues.
Now the thing, just to touch on that, John, and it's like what I find incredible, but to me we're seeing this now across so many sports. So if you look at it from a team or even a business, or let's go to really simple terms like a clock. So you need on a clock, a business and a team, every single individual component to do their job for you to be successful.
Yep.
Now, the business models we see today is people have created these silos. Now, I hate that word, business silos. But you've got silos, you've got departments, and those departments have become little enclaves of their own. And the problem you've got is because all of those have their own KPIs and they have their own profit divisions that they've got to make money within those to cover the costs of those departments, what we're seeing is this crossover. So the times when they need to actually work together doesn't happen. It breaks down. They just stay enclosed in their little pods and work independently. Because now if that wasn't the case, and if we look at it with the case of the Matildas, then you would go, well, why is Luke Casley, who's the head of national teams, not been dragged through the ringer? And also Emma Highwood, who's the head of women's football. Because if this was an issue with a national team, which is the Matildas, a women's football thing, why have they not lost their jobs as well? Why were they not across it? What were they doing to make sure that this situation didn't occur? Why was it not nipped in the bud earlier? And this is what I think is gone wrong, is it is a dysfunctional organisation in that the way it's being run. And then, of course, if those people were not involved, then you have to go up to the CEO and go, well, CEO, why are you not making sure that those people were doing their jobs so that this never happened? And to me, it's just a absolute great example of a really badly run organisation. And again, if you look at the whole public relations disaster that it's been in terms of the media releases, the press conferences that were held, there's another department not working the way it should, not avoiding extra drama, extra media coverage that is of a negative variety, because it was handled badly. So again, you look at that and you go, you are a dysfunctional organisation, but you've hung someone else out to dry, but it has now exposed how badly run you are.
How does it get to the point where a coach is sacked without anything being done beforehand to remedy situations? Because obviously they've done nothing about whatever has been this festering sore within the Matildas camp.
But the other thing I find incredible is, you know, coaches get sacked. And there are always people that are disgruntled in a sporting environment. As Tom Somani came out and said, you know, you're not doing your job if there aren't players that are upset. In fact, as a coach, you want players to be upset that they're not in the team.
Driving
because they'll
competition.
Yeah, exactly. It drives the competition, which gives you a stronger squad to work with, which will then hopefully bring you success. Now, what I find interesting is how many of the Matildas have openly come out and said they, and I know a lot of them, and they do love Alan Stagey. I mean, here's a guy who was a teacher. He's been involved in women's football for 20 years. And you can't tell me suddenly, how do you survive 20 years if you're creating a toxic environment? How would you survive in a school as a teacher if you were doing that? And it's just, anyone that knows Alan Stagey just can't believe what he's being accused of.
I would also suggest that there'd be a lot of nations in the world that would be happy to take on the toxic environment that Alan Stagey apparently brings with him if they could get to number four in the world. They'd be happy with that. And they've made a rod for their own back because they're ranked number four in the world. So from this point on, they've sacked him over performance.
I think they're six now, but
six?
Yeah, they were four.
Okay. Any result less than a semi-final berth is pretty much going to be a failure. And in fact, it's almost to the point where they've set them up for failure.
I don't envy whoever comes in. They're going to have a very hard job.
Who comes in is going to be very interesting to see, isn't it? Because it'll say a lot about what's actually behind this sacking to start with, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on there the surveys. And again, what annoys me, John, is first of all, and we know that there's this thing now, surveys are all anonymous, but isn't it funny how sometimes you get emails then from the company that just surveyed you and you're going, well, hang on a second, I thought it was anonymous. But what gets me here is anonymity, and we see it on the web so much now, that people will make and they troll and they abuse people and they're not held accountable for those words that they say which are hurtful, defamatory or whatever. And I think that, again, having anonymous surveys, you're pandering to those people. So you're giving them the opportunity to actually just talk crap or just be abusive or come out with stuff that is offensive just because they can, and they can hide behind that anonymity. But the thing that concerns me most of all with an anonymous survey is it's like a referendum. You can word the question to get the answers that you want.
Yep.
And so, especially when it's anonymous, you hide behind that anonymity because you don't know the answers that the people who are actually you're asking to do the survey. But then you've loaded the questions to get the answers that you want. So whoever's doing the survey, it's a win-win for them. There is no accountability whatsoever in the survey. And I would say there's no credibility in a survey like that.
Well, you've got two surveys as well. We're talking about the one that was conducted, was it through the Players Association survey?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one survey, which he was fully involved with, I believe.
Yeah, he was, and they were discussing that as well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, then you've got another group brought in from the outside by the FFA, I'm assuming without necessarily the consent of the coach. And the group that they brought in is a group that specifically looks at violence against women. Violence.
And that survey was still open until last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then it got somebody works managed to get into it, said you could still fill it in. And then within about a few hours, it was reported in, I think it was The Australian, that it was available to be filled in till last week. And then suddenly they took it down.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like when we saw cricket ask the Sydney Ethics Centre to do the report on Australia's ball tampering and Cricket Australia and their toxic culture. And when you ask an ethics committee to do anything to do with sport, they're going to find heaps of stuff, because sport doesn't work along the intellectual lines that ethics committees do. It is a different beast, and you cannot use the boundaries of intellectual discussion to measure a sporting group. It's just crazy.
But to me, John, as well, an electronic survey. So you imagine, you're part of the Matilda squad, you receive this, you might go flick it on to me and go, oh, have a look at this that I've been asked to fill in. Then I can fill it in because it's anonymous, and I can load it to whatever you may say. Oh, look, can you go in and fill it in and say Alan's a bad guy or whatever? And suddenly this snowball grows because I'll share it with somebody else. And that's why I don't agree with these surveys. And I think you're better off sitting in a room face to face with somebody and talking to them.
That usually works. And I think the other side of it is the caliber of the players that have come out. And it's just about all of the Matildas. But some of the first to come out and say stuff were some of the stars of the team. And we both know that very often when cultures aren't going right and things aren't working well, it is actually the stars that lead the players in that sort of thing. And here are the stars coming out saying, no way, we love the bloke. There's, what are you doing? And whoever picks, they pick as a coach is on a highway to nowhere. And they're going to, because the players aren't going to be really that keen. It's always going to be back in the mind that this is a stitch up to get this person a job.
Yeah, look, I think that there needs to be a revamp as well in the FFA. You cannot just get rid of the head coach for the reasons that you've given and not have other people held accountable either. So.
Isn't that what they're there for? Their job titles say it. I mean, you know, you high performance managers and all these sorts of people, and you, as you mentioned, the positions they hold, they've got to be held as just as much to account as the coach does. Because that's exactly their job. The coach is there to coach them in games to win. These are the people whose job it is to look after the culture.
Totally agree with you, John.
Not to worry. We'll see what happens.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and time for our guest on this podcast. And as I mentioned, I've been trying to catch up with this young lady for a very long time, and she grew up in Bathurst, she was living in Western Australia, and then she decided to back herself and turn professional in the brutal world of boxing. But she's been successful, and at the end of last year won the World Boxing Federation Women's Intercontinental Super Bantamweight World Title. Wow. And we're talking about Kylie Fulmer. Now, just before we get to her, as I mentioned, the Skype line was not the best through to Las Vegas. At the beginning, you will break up a little bit, but I can tell you it will get better. So please stick with it. And here is Kylie Fulmer. Kylie Fulmer, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hey Ash, thanks for having me on. It's great to finally catch up with you and fill each other in on what's been happening since I seen last in Perth.
I know, it's been a long time and a lot has happened to you, but I wanted to sort of start to when we first met, which was very much when you were an amateur boxer here in Western Australia and trying to get a place at the Olympics and the Commonwealth Games. And I mean, how difficult was it, and why did you move from Queensland to Perth?
Yeah, sure. It's been a crazy journey, that's for sure. And I never forget the day I first seen you, and grateful to cross paths with Azuma Nelson and a massive friend and mentor of mine, David Harper. I was, you know, stoked to come in and get the time I did that Azuma gave me that day. I pretty much come over to Perth, I think it was like a couple of years before I met you guys, and I started boxing just for fun, and I just put on a pair of gloves, and it pretty much took over my whole life. So much I'll just, you know, cover how I started. I got an opportunity on a super yacht at the business in Australia for over 8 years detailing boats, and that put me in connection with a boat owner over in Perth, and I had an opportunity to jump on board a super yacht and travel the world for 4 years as a first mate bosun deckhand, and made the opportunity that, you know, so I took the opportunity and went over there. And as soon as I arrived, I thought, you know, I've always been into fitness, so I've got to keep fit. And I would detail the boats during the day and then would run to the gym in the afternoon. And found a gym over there, and the same thing, you know, I put on a pair of gloves and thought, I just love this. I love this sport. And basically got an opportunity to have my first fight as a novice. And it all led from there. So it's, I think that was my first fight, and now we're up to, I think I finished at 54 amateur fights.
Yeah, we just lost you there a sec, but 54 amateur fights is quite a few, but it didn't sort of go always the way you wanted, did it? I mean, you had the trouble with amateur boxing. Sometimes the decisions, like in professional boxing, don't go your way.
Exactly. And I think, you know, just coming into the sport as a new raw fighter, I had a really fast track career. I went from, you know, winning the novice titles within 2 weeks of pulling on a pair of gloves and getting the opportunity to fight, to, I think it was a few weeks later, went from a novice title to a state title. And within 3 months, I had the opportunity to go and represent Western Australia for on the Western Australian team for the Australian titles. You know, and it's so funny, as I got in there, I look back now after all these years and understand and know the mistakes I was making, why the points probably weren't scoring. I used to fight with all heart. I had no knowledge. It was just, you know, all fitness and heart and get in. And my mindset was my turn, no turn for you, because I really didn't have anything else to sort of go off apart from fitness. I remember when I first met Azuma, I, you know, hit the pads and just wouldn't stop. It would just be high work rate, as hard and as fast as I could throw, and you know, just hopefully they connect.
One of the things I find interesting is obviously your amateur career, and it, without sort of putting it down, it wasn't sort of, you didn't reach the pinnacle, you didn't go to the sort of world championships, you didn't go to the Olympic Games. So what made you decide to turn professional? Because to some, that would have been a very bold step.
When I started with the boxing, it was, you know, that was my vision the whole way. And I just feel that I think the style that I had as an amateur,
do you think again that that's where maybe turning professional benefited you? Because you know, you've admitted there that you were a slow starter in the ring, and obviously amateur boxing, 3 rounds, you don't have very long to get it right, basically, whereas in the professional field you have a little bit longer.
Definitely. I think that's a big advantage for me now. You know, coming from an endurance background, as an endurance athlete from marathon running and swimming, I did find it a little bit hard to turn on the first few rounds, and especially being 2 minute rounds, they're so short, like you just get adjusted and start to find your rhythm and your flow and your distance, and then the fight would be over. I'd always be, you know, never feel happy or, you know, I think take any positives away from the fight, because I felt like I never got to really showcase my skills in the amateurs.
I mean, once you decided to turn professional, you headed overseas. I mean, was it difficult to find somebody that would take you on?
I lived in the Philippines with the national boxing team and went to Thailand multiple times over there to train with the junior national team, because I felt like I really needed to focus on that. The basic fundamentals of boxing, it's something I never really picked up on, and putting myself in, you know, places like Eastern Thailand. I lived on campus with the national teams and tried to learn boxing from the ground up. I feel, looking back now, it's the most important thing. If you, if you don't know what to throw, when to throw, and why to throw, it's very hard as a to actually understand what you're even doing in there. And you know, it all makes sense now, the path I took, and I'm so happy I did it all, you know, that the way I have. I wouldn't change it for anything, because it's given me so much knowledge over the years to work all over the world with some of the most amazing coaches and learn so many different things. When I went over to Taipei back to the tournament, I got a silver medal. It was my first international medal. I had this crazy idea to, you know, go home to Australia and training and go for the Olympic trials, or take a chance and fly into America. And my crazy mindset was to go over there and train with the Mexicans. And to be honest, I thought to myself, well, Mexicans, and learn how to knock them out, because it's the only way I'm going to win. And that's what I did. I was sitting in Taipei and I made a phone call to Dave, and I discussed this with him and said, look, this is what I'm thinking. And Dave being Dave, he said to me, you get on the plane. He booked me a ticket, and we went over there. And I remember landing in LA and got myself a bus to the Venice Beach Backpackers. And I planned to find myself a boat to live on and get out of the boat, and that would give me a place to stay, and I could find a gym to train out of, you know, 2-3 times a day for the month that I was there, to give myself the best shot to, you know, try and make the Australian team.
I find it interesting that you said you wanted to train with the Mexicans, because there's an almost an irony there that you are now obviously the World Boxing Federation Women's Intercontinental Super Bantamweight Champion, and that was against a Mexican. So it was almost like you took back what you'd learnt, and it led to you winning a world title.
Really, it's been off that feeling, follow your heart and, you know, do what feels right. And I really did take a massive chance going over there. I had like $800 in my back pocket and a backpack. I knew nobody over there. The bizarre thing was I planned to stay in LA and find a gym there, but some good friends of mine that were actually at a gym I was training at in Australia with in WA at the same time, and they landed and they said to me, what are you doing in LA? And I said to them, oh, you know, I'm here to train. They said, oh, we're going to Las Vegas for the weekend, would you like to come with us and you know, watch the competition? So I thought to myself, oh, I've got nowhere else to stay, you know, I'm at the Venice Beach Backpackers. So I jumped in the car and I planned to come back on the Monday morning to the comp with them. And after arriving in LA, I was still jet lagged, so I typical grabbed my bag and caught a taxi to a gym that I actually knew of, and it was where one of the Olympic coaches had trained, Ismael Salas. He's a great, used to train the Cuban Olympic team. And I thought I'd go there on the off chance on a Saturday and just see if he was there, and no one was around, so I did like 22 minute rounds in the bag. And that's the typical way I used to train, you know, overdo everything. And I never forget this little girl come over to me, and she goes, oh, she's trying to teach me to dance. And I said to her, look, white girls can't move, we've got no swag. And I was laughing around with her, and this man come over, and he looked familiar, but I didn't really know his face. And he goes, what are you training so hard for? And I told him my story, and he goes, oh, so what's your downfall? And I had a big black eye at the time from the tournament in Taipei, and I pointed to the black eye and I said, oh, dance. And he laughed. He had a big smile on his face, and he goes to me, well, my son's the greatest fighter of all time, and I'm the greatest coach. And that guy was Floyd Mayweather Senior's, that was Floyd Mayweather's father, Floyd Senior.
And the rest is history, because you did train with him in the end, didn't you?
I did. I spent about 14 months with Floyd Senior, and grateful that he gave me the opportunity to stay. Like, it was a long story, everything that happened, and, you know, the ups and downs I've had over the years. But, you know, if it wasn't for him at the start, I wouldn't have even stayed in Las Vegas. And I suppose it wasn't only the journey of boxing, it was the position I put me in, living out of my comfort zone so much, like having no money. When he gave me the opportunity to stay there, I had no house, no car. And I just Googled and found this little converted studio with a single mattress on the floor. And, you know, being in a fighter mindset, I thought I'll do whatever it takes. Like, if it means train with the best, I'm here. I'm ready for it. So every morning I'd get up and run with my mouth guard in my pocket, and just in case, you know, it's such a rough area I was in, and you know, living on off adrenaline every day, and just I made it through there, thankfully, safe. And yeah, it's put me in a position today where I live with a good beautiful family. They give me a, you know, not only a house to live in, but I've got a beautiful family and a good environment around me now that makes it a lot easier to be over here.
I mean, you are a world champion now, and obviously every boxer dreams that one day that opportunity is going to come their way. It came to you relatively quickly. I mean, was there apprehension going into that fight, or was it just, you know, this is my dream and I'm going to grab it now?
Yeah, every day was the unknown, you know, like if I had so many ups and downs, and having to leave every 3 months with visa runs, then ended up in random countries trying to earn a few dollars just to get airfares back, and trying to survive is really more so the hardest thing I went through. That fight, you know, you really got to invest in yourself to build your professional record. I've learned over the years how much professional boxing is a business, and it's been, you know, super tough. People think you're making a killing over here and you're getting paid big dollars, but you've actually, you know, living off nothing just to build that record and trying to develop to actually get a good opportunity to fight to even get paid. That fight, a lot of people don't, you know, sort of understand what it truly meant to me. It wasn't really about a world title or the belts or anything, because the night I stepped into that ring and I had my team, you know, behind me, I was fighting for my freedom to stay here in America and make a life around boxing and doing what I love. So when I went into the ring, failing wasn't an option, because I've put too much in now to just come this far. Yeah, every time I get in there, I think that I've just gotta give it all and fight for the future that I want.
I mean, is there the chance of money down the track? I mean, we know that the male boxers and Floyd Mayweather, who you touched on there, has made a fortune from boxing. But I mean, obviously the women's game doesn't earn those sort of numbers. But could you make a living now, and it will be easier as time goes on?
Well, hopefully it does. You know, there's definitely, women's boxing is definitely developing, and I think there is definitely a lot more opportunity than what there has been in the past. But it's all a stepping stone, and happy now that, you know, I can finally see my box record is starting to develop. I've just hit number one in America, and 18 out of 120 in the super bantamweight division, which I think the real way as a female fighter to make money is not so much, you're never going to make a huge amount of money out of fighting, but if you can market yourself well and develop, you know, a good following and promote the real reasons why you're fighting, you can definitely probably make more as an ambassador out of the ring also. So that's the path I'm sort of working towards. any money you get as a fighter is a bonus, I guess. I think if you go expecting it, you could run into huge disappointments. So I'm really using boxing as a tool to make a life around fighting and around my passion, and stepping into more, not only learning as a fighter, but as a coach in future, mentoring and hopefully inspiring other people to, you know, chase their dreams. That's sort of, you know, why I do it. If I did it for the money, I definitely would have quit a long time ago, I think.
I mean, you talk about inspiring another generation coming through and letting other people realize that you can achieve your dreams. Do you see that being in the USA, or do you see that as being back in Australia or wherever an opportunity arises? Because as you said, you've got that backpack, you can sling it over your shoulder and go wherever you like.
Definitely. And I've used boxing as a tool to travel the world. Like, I started boxing late. I was 27 when I started, and I didn't even have a passport when I, you know, when I was 27. So now I've filled up 4 passports, and I could say I've used boxing as a tool for pretty much all of that, to travel and not only fight but get life experience in traveling and life also. So I think when you say where, like, definitely international for me. I don't, you know, obviously plan to base myself out of Australia one day again, but for now, I don't want to so much be Kylie the boxer or brand myself as that. I want to make my own brand, make my own legacy. I don't want to fight under somebody else's brand or become Kylie the boxer, because we usually spend such a long time now in our life to find our true identity and be the real you, create the person you really are. And I feel like the last year especially, I've really stepped into my own 2 feet, so to speak, and I'm very very headstrong about the person I have become and the beliefs I have in life and why I'm doing what I'm doing. I've started doing a lot of seminars and speaking to, like, for example, I had a seminar on the weekend with 20 ladies, and I had the pleasure of sharing my story, not so much just about boxing, but life in general, and I was pretty blown away by how much of an impact you can make on somebody else's life just by telling them that, you know, the storms that you've walked through to be where you are. Like, with social media these days, people don't look at it in a realistic way, they just think, oh yeah, she's living the dream, it must be easy, you know, she's just won an intercontinental world title, you know, but they don't see the struggles of behind it and what she's doing to make all that happen.
No, exactly. Well, obviously you're going to have to defend that title soon. Is that coming up soon?
Yeah, definitely, Ash, and I'm really looking forward to it. You know, like, I feel like that last fight was a good fight, and these last 6 fights as a professional have really helped me find my feet and adjust to the different art form of professional fighting. It's very different to amateurs. And you know, I feel that, now I've got the ring craft and the confidence and finding my own professional style, and now we're working up to these next, the 10 rounder fights. I think it's going to be a huge advantage for me because, I don't really start to turn on to the later rounds. And, I think the last fight was, I finished in the 4th. But I feel like I didn't get to really showcase my skills and what we've been working on in training. So, the next fight, we've got another 10 rounder in Germany, and I'll be fighting for a new title called the LBF Federation. So it's an LBF super bantamweight intercontinental world title, and I'm hoping that, you know, I've got a world class opponent and we can really push to go, you know, go the distance and get myself a challenge to really bring out the best in me also.
Well, Carly, it's been great catching up with you. We wish you all the best with that, and you know I'll be following you with great interest. But look, thanks for joining us today, and it's been a fantastic journey, and we wish you all the best as it continues.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I'd just like to also say thank you to all my supporters out there that have been there, you know, along the journey, you two especially. It's all those little messages that have kept me going over the years, and with that never give up mindset. If it wasn't people like Dave Harper and all my sponsors that I've had along the way, I don't want to mention them all or anyone. So those people all know who they are, and I can't wait to get back in the ring this year and as we keep aiming towards the top.
Well, good luck and thanks again.
Thanks so much, Ash. I appreciate your time.
This is Floyd Mayweather Sr., and you are now listening to the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. Good work, John, seeing as Floyd Mayweather was the first coach that Kylie had there in the USA, and a great story of how she met him and worked with him. And brilliant that we were able to get him on the Sting straight after the interview. But that was, as I mentioned, Carly Fulmer. And what a great story. And it was fantastic to hear that she's had various people and businesses supporting her. But, you know, and also that family that she's living with in Las Vegas, who've taken her in, given her a room, made sure that she's fed, because female boxers do not get paid the big bucks.
Where would boxing be without Las Vegas?
Without Joe Cortez saying it's the boxing capital of the world.
No, but I mean, it appears as though boxing very much revolves around Las Vegas at the moment. It's the centre of the boxing world.
It is. I mean, it shifted, didn't it? I mean, yeah. It used to be that New York and Madison Square Garden was the place.
And even generally just the East Coast. Philadelphia were holding big fights, places like that.
Yeah. And I mean, Boston's produced a few great ones, including Marvelous Marvin Hagler, who is one of my favourites.
Oh, they had the fighter on TV the other night too. That was
Mickey Ward
film.
As well.
Mickey Ward, there were a few fighters came out of Boston just quietly.
Exactly. But we should move ahead. But okay. Congratulations to Kylie, and we do wish you all the best, because you're going to be defending your title this year, and hopefully the fight in Germany goes well.
Good luck to her. Okay, let's move on to a bit of cricket talk, shall we? Because there's plenty to talk about in the world of cricket. Shall we start with the Big Bash?
Well, you know I don't watch T20, John.
What's it turned into? I mean, Cricket Australia must be really frustrated that they've taken a step to extend the competition. And I get the idea why you'd want to play everybody play home and away one. You know, I understand that. I think it's a good idea to do that, but the competition has just dragged on and on, and to have almost a week between the last game and the final starting, it's just another nail in it as far as I'm concerned.
But John, cricket's made this mistake before. If you remember, we talked about this. The very first Cricket World Cup, you know, it lasted 10 days. It was all done and dusted. Now, the Cricket World Cup lasts about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's dull. It's boring. You lose track of it. And look, T20, I'm sorry, I don't watch it. I'm not interested. I'm a purist. and I just think it's not that great, you know, and it's too tilted towards the batsman. So I prefer to see a bowler and a genuine battle between bat and ball.
Look, I must admit, I have it on when I'm working in the shed and stuff. But I don't follow it as such. You know, I'm not scanning tables and trying to work out whose run rate's got to improve to make the finals and all that sort of stuff. And for us here in Perth, it's been a particularly disappointing season. One of the main disappointments has been the splitting of the coverage between pay TV and free-to-air television. Now, I understand sport's got to go where the money is, and I hope you concur with me. You know, Channel 7 bid for the rights, said they were going to pay for the rights, won the rights, and then had to sell the rights because they couldn't afford them. And that's when, honestly, someone like Cricket Australia should step in and say, well, no, you've got to show them because you bid for them. If you're going to split it up across multiple platforms, different broadcasters, we're going to take it back off you and give it to a broadcaster that will provide the service that we need.
But this is the problem, John, and it's not just in cricket. It's across the board we're seeing this. Take the FIFA World Cup in Qatar. Yeah. You know, the bidding documents said that the World Cup had to be held in the European summer months. So, therefore, Qatar was never going to win it playing it in those months. Now, they've, of course, managed to change it, and it's going to be held at a different time. But if you, these governing bodies have got to stick to the criteria, because it's not fair that you award it to, say, Qatar and Channel 7. The others could go, well, we could have put a very different document together if we'd been allowed to move it or run it when we wanted it,
yeah.
Or if we didn't have to show all of the games, or we could actually sublet some of the coverage to somebody else.
And once you let those sorts of rules slide by, you have no moral authority to turn around and judge someone else. You know, if they came to us and said, oh, well, you can't do that because X, Y, and Z, I'd say, well, you've got no jurisdiction because you've already allowed this. You've already let your rules and regulations and bylaws, whatever, be changed to suit this sort of stuff. You can't now come and slam me. I'm just not recognising that.
Yeah.
Because you have no authority. You've lost your authority as soon as you allow those situations to happen.
As soon as you blur the lines, then you've got real issues, and it's open to so much down the track. It's ridiculous.
We saw that happen with the Pro League, in the formation of the Pro League. You know, they were told, teams were told, you had to have men and women. Both your men and women's teams were going to have to play in the Pro League.
I'm talking hockey now.
Hockey, yep. So what happens? India don't want to play their women. The FIH says, well, your men can't play, so India goes, fine, has a little hissy fit. Then they turn around and find that there's countries that are only playing with one gender. So how does the FIH have any authority there to tell anybody anything about what they can or can't do? Because they're changing the rules all the time. There is no rule.
Well, the frustrating one for me is the squads are meant to be announced 48 hours before the game. And because there's a lot of travel for me having to commentate, I need to see those so that I can do my prep on the teams because I'm travelling.
Yeah.
And otherwise I can't do it, or I'm having to do it at the very, very last minute. But most of the teams are just ignoring that, or if they are now, what we're seeing happen, and I've actually raised this, is teams are just going, okay, just to meet the deadline, put any old team in.
Yeah.
Then you turn up on the match day and there's four or five changes to the team that they actually announced. Now, it doesn't matter the starting lineup, but the squad should be the same. But also, the squads were meant to be, you were bound by those, you couldn't change them unless someone
32.
Was... Yeah, unless somebody was injured. But a couple of teams have already thrown in new faces that weren't in the initial...
Oh, a lot of them just didn't name full squads, did they?
Yeah, which again was a bit of a strange one.
Yeah, but getting back to the cricket, I mean, it hasn't been, A, the money spin of the cricket authorities thought it would be. It hasn't been the crowd pleaser. And you can guarantee if the Perth Scorchers here, for instance, come out and lose the first three games of next year, you're going to have 10,000 people in a 60,000 seat stadium.
They might have to move back to the Wacker.
Well, the crowds have been the interesting thing for Mind, because they are obviously down over a greater number of games.
But what people have got to realise as well, John, is that the economy is not the greatest. People can't afford to spend vast sums of money going to watch sport if they're having trouble paying their bills at home, and if they're having to pay for little Johnny and Sarah to be playing junior sport when the prices are going up to do that. So you can't have it at both ends, where you want these families to come and watch sport and at the same time you want them to participate in sport, and you're charging them like a wounded bull at both ends.
Well, one of the things that Big Bash had done really successfully is corner that school holiday market, and as soon as they took the competition outside the confines of school holidays, they were going to be in trouble, and they've done that and they're in trouble.
Just quickly on the cricket as well,
yeah.
I want to just say Ricky Ponting now involved with the Australian men's team. Hopefully we won't see him on any more betting advertisements, because with a guy whose nickname is Punter, involved with a sport that has had betting issues in recent times, the last thing you need is an assistant coach promoting betting in that environment. So hopefully Cricket Australia, before they appointed him, have made him terminate his contract with that betting
company. I would have thought
company.
That was a no-brainer. And any of, well, I don't think as an official of Cricket Australia, he could hold that position, could he?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so. I think it's a very strange appointment.
Oh, players can't. I'm pretty sure coaches are banned from having anything to do with sporting, from betting bodies, aren't they? So Ricky, I assume, would be in that boat as well. Unless this is going to be another case of a rule being broken to bend to appease someone and then...
Hey, well, they changed the rules for Ricky Ponting before, remember? He played for Tasmania and he was the only first player ever in Australian Sheffield Shield history to not live in the state that he played for.
Yeah.
Now, again, you know, they may well bend the rules for him once more.
Oh, it would be terrible if they didn't. Also, Alison Mitchell over here for the cricket commentator over here for the
one of the best commentators in, I think, of cricket in the world today.
I would agree with you. She's fantastic, and I've got to take my hat off to Alison because, look, the Sri Lankan team turned up to play a couple of tests, and the commentary box on Channel 7 is pretty matey, old school Aussie boys, and didn't they all just get a laugh with Dick Weller? The poor bloke didn't choose his name, but the Aussie commentators, look, I went to primary school, I get it, Dick Weller, ha ha ha, laugh once, get over it. But the blokes in that commentary box just couldn't help themselves. You could hear the giggling at times, laughing about it. And I want to congratulate Alison Mitchell for bringing some decorum back into the whole commentary box and by pronouncing his name Dick Weller. Well done to Alison Mitchell. She is a shining light in the cricketing world of commentary, especially when it's just boring blokes laughing at stupid primary school jokes.
Well, that brings to mind the story of Mike Trebilco played for Everton when they won the FA Cup, and he scored two in the FA Cup final. Didn't score the winner, but it was Wolstenholme, the commentator who we have on as our sting for the show. And when Everton were in there, they were saying, well, he said, how do you say your name? And he goes, Treblecock. And the BBC said, no, we can't have that. So he said, I was called Trebilco because of that FA Cup final, because the BBC decided that it was not appropriate to call me by my proper name, which was Treblecock. So from that day on, he was Mike Trebilco.
And look, I'm a grown up, you know, yeah, giggle once, but get over it. The constant sniggering in the background was just disgraceful.
But the one that annoys me as well is Labuschagne, who's playing for Australia now, and how nobody is making the effort to say his name the way... And I was talking to a South African at the weekend who was saying they were livid that he's accepting this sort of awful pronunciation of his name that the Aussie commentators have come up with.
Is there, do any two commentators say it the same way?
Labuschagne, and I mean, it's Labuschagne, you know, it's not that hard to say.
Not
if
for you.
Learn how to say it.
Not for you. I've got to admit, I'm terrible with pronouncing certain names.
Yeah, Srijesh is one you struggle with. I've heard that many a time on your podcast, yeah, the reverse stick.
I don't know what it is. It's probably wrong of me to do that, but I struggle with names and try and spend a lot of time getting right, especially some of these European hockey club names. They're absolute doozies. But if you have a go and you're trying to do the right thing, I think people will accept that.
I think I had another topic, but I think I'm going to keep it for another day, John. I think
okay.
We'll save that one up. Just finally before we go, congratulations to Simon Hill and Craig Foster for the work they did in getting Hakim Al-Arabi out of custody in Thailand and back to Australia, and everybody that supported them along the way. Fantastic effort, and certainly those two gentlemen, high profile guys in the media, in football, did a really good job in making awareness.
And let's face it, you know, for a long time there, Craig was pushing the barrow up a very, very steep hill, and it looked like it was all going to be in vain, but for whatever reasons, all that effort paid off and authorities changed their minds, and you know, now the guy's got a chance to get on with his life.
Has indeed.
And congratulations on your work on the Pro League coverage too. If you're out there, folks, you should check your local broadcasters and listen to Ashley and the broadcast. Your co-commentators have been excellent as well. It's been really great, and the hockey's been very entertaining.
The hockey has been fantastic. Well, seeing as we have gone down that path,
okay,
John, I'm just going to touch on the point that I had. And I think the Pro League has been outstanding. What I find upsetting, and it's something that really gets my goat these days, is so many of the media operations don't put the names of the writers who write the various articles. So they just put staff writer. Now, I think legally they should have to put the name of the person that put the article together. But we had in The Australian on Monday, after the games in Hobart, AAP put out a piece, and they were going that hockey, Australia had won the double over Germany. Well, they didn't. The men won, the women played a two-all draw, and then it went to a shootout. And the way the Hockey Pro League works, or the FIH Hockey Pro League works, is you then have a shootout to gain a bonus point for on the league ladder. And Australia won the shootout, and they won the bonus point, but they did not win the game. And yet the story said they won the game.
Oh, that look, they're not the only ones there. And when you get national associations posting the same thing, saying, oh, we won, or they won, or whoever won the game, when they patently didn't, just shows they haven't even read the rules. You know, you've got to shake your head and wonder, don't you?
You do indeed.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.